I'm Nick Harcourt, and welcome to another episode of The Sound of Success, the podcast where we talk with movers, shakers, and just plain cool people about music. Our guest on this episode of The Sound of Success is musician, producer, and composer Camilo Lara. Camilo is perhaps best known for music that he releases under the name Mexican Institute of Sound, with 6 full-length albums released since 2006 and a recent compilation, Algoritmo Hits, 2004 through 2024. He's also a highly sought-after producer, and his list of collaborators is long and impressive. Sly and Robbie, Tom Tom Club, Gabby Moreno, Calexico, and Nora Jones are just a few. Camilo is in high demand as a remixer as well, having worked on tracks by many artists, including Metallica, Run the Jewels, Beck, Madness, Beastie Boys, and Julieta Venegas. He's also worked in television and film, initially as a music supervisor and more recently as a composer, with credits ranging from TV's Californication and Netflix's Narcos Mexico to movies like Y Tu Mama Tambien, Pixar's Coco, and Disney's Black Panther Wakanda Forever. Camilo recently picked up an Emmy for his work on the Apple TV show Home. He's also a part of Damien Albarn's African Express project that facilitates collaborations between African, Middle Eastern, and Western musicians. So, first up, it's not that often I get to do these interviews in person, let alone in another country. But I've been in Mexico City, my first time, for a few days, and we're speaking today in your Soy Sauce studio. Thank you for your hospitality.
Hi, Nick. So good to have you in Mexico City, finally.
It is. We've been talking about it for a long time, and the stars lined up.
Yes, and such a pleasure to have you at my Soy Sauce studio in Mexico.
So we'll get to the music questionnaire in a little while, but first up, maybe we can get a little background. Maybe you could tell me about growing up in Coyoacán. That's your hometown, a little south of Mexico City, right?
Yeah. Well, I'm from the south of the city, which is where Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera lived. Trotsky lived there. Mm-hmm. So it's a very left-wing part of the city. Just because it's near the university, so most of the teachers and people that works at the university live there. So historically, it's been a very forward-thinking, very progressive neighborhood. And yeah, I mean, I spent all my childhood there until I moved to La Roma, which is where we are now. La Roma, which is now famous for the Alfonso Cuarón film Roma. It's a very interesting part of the city because for many years it got empty because there was a big earthquake on 85 and it got most of the buildings got damaged. So it got empty from 85, 86 until 2000, early 2000. And then young people like me at that time started moving there to get these great houses, very cheap. And we started coming back to this part of the city.
What kind of a kid were you? What were you into as a kid when you were growing up?
Well, I feel very lucky because when I was growing up, my older brother was in a new wave band. And my parents were very generous to allow all the bands to rehearse at their house.
Wow.
So when I was growing up, when I was 6 or 7, I spent all the afternoons on the kitchen of my parents just listening to my brother rehearse and then other bands to rehearse. So I live all the 80s explosion of rock and español through my parents' kitchen, and I managed to meet all the big stars like Caifanes, Maldita Vecindad, Café Tacuba. They all rehearsed there, so they met me when I was this young, annoying kid that knew everything about music and asked a million questions a minute about like production and credits and guitars, and like I was very curious and my life was in the credits of the album, so I was obsessed with joining the dots and just finding who played with who and who was in friends with who and what label was it and all that sort of things that credits on albums let you think.
It's interesting because when I was a kid growing up as well, when we had 12-inch vinyl albums and used to have so much more information. I mean, now it's on the web. It was on CDs or whatever. But when you had a 12-inch album, that was full of information about your band and who was on it and where it was recorded and all that kind of stuff. And it seems now that you're telling me that ultimately led to the collaborative nature of your work. But before we talk about that, let me just jump back a little bit again. So music around, obviously, with your brother and the family and bands rehearsing at your parents' place. What about other art? What about movies? Were you into film as a kid as well?
Yeah, I mean, I was trying to absorb everything that was near me. My parents were... because they were teachers from the university. They tried to take me to like these art film cycles that were happening at the cinema near us. So I saw so many movies that were not allowed to watch. I saw it when I was a kid. Like I saw Clockwise Orange when I was like 14 or so.
Movies probably, you shouldn't have seen as a kid.
Yeah, and probably I got permanently damaged because of that. But at the same time, I feel very lucky because I think I understood the world very young and I saw things that completely helped me to think what I love. And when I started like looking for novels that I found, like and I discovered like people like William Burroughs or Ginsberg, or I saw that there were other misfits like me, like when I was 14 or so. Like, so I started feeling like the world was wider than I thought.
So at 15, I believe, you started working for a record label, right? You started working at EMI, Mexico.
Yeah, it's a sweet and sour story because... when I was 13, I started managing a couple of bands in Mexico, including a band called Titan.
Titan, I remember having Titan on Morning Becomes Eclectic 25 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, they're still around. So, yeah. But I was managing my other brother band and Titan and other bands. So I did a show, my very first rock show in a very beautiful place. I sold all the tickets and everything was going fantastic. And one day prior the show, the Mexican candidate for presidency got shot killed. So they declare the next day morning. So everything shut down. And of course, my show got canceled. And I lost all my money. So for a kid, I thought my world was over, like my career was over. I was very depressed, but the next day, I got an offer to start working on EMI as a radio promoter. So I mean, it was a sign. So I took it and I started my record industry career there.
You also were working in radio as well. You did a radio show, right?
I used to have a radio show at that time, yeah.
I love it when I meet successful people and you're the successful guy who started in radio. It makes me feel like there's still hope for me.
What are you talking about? Like, I follow your steps, so for me that's the biggest form of success.
Did you know that Willie Nelson started as a radio DJ as well? I remember when I met him, he told me he started as a DJ and I was like, oh my gosh, I'm in the right job.
Yeah, I mean, I felt so lucky. And that was prior working on EMI. I had a very obsessive compulsion to buy records. So my parents were not rich. They were kind of middle classer. And so they gave me money enough to like go to the school and have lunch and that's it. So I had to work and I started working as a waiter to buy records. So every time I did like one shift, I buy an album. So I was working at this restaurant, very low profile restaurant, and someone sat at the table and they were like, oh, what a great music you're playing. And I told him, like, yeah, I'm obsessed with music and I just bought these albums. And so long story short, they were a team that they were opening a radio station in Mexico. So they hired me to program that radio station, which happens to be Alejandro González Iñárritu radio station.
It's funny because, the film director as well, who I first met when he did Amores Perros, he started as a DJ as well.
He was a very successful radio personality. Yeah. So he opened this new radio station and I was part of that team. So I spent a couple of years just producing, cutting tape and editing. And just I used to do a show called with Casey called America's Top 40. Mm. So I was the Mexican producer for that. And Alejandro González was the voice on that, the Mexican voice.
So I would imagine working at a record label, that gives you access to records for sure. I mean, your record collection must have really started to build up once you started working for EMI. And take me through that process, because I know you worked there for about, 10 years? And by the time you left, you were actually running the place.
Yes. It was because record labels were firing everyone. So I was the last man standing. It has nothing to do with talent.
That happened to me in Woodstock as well. I just stuck around and there was nobody left. And eventually I got the gig.
That can't support that much drinking and everything. So it was like me like that. Like I was last man standing. I was smart enough not to get fired. So I ended up being the boss. I signed a bunch of stuff. So I was very lucky because on my generation, there were a bunch of artists and people doing interesting things. And it was like a very strong creative cluster happening in Mexico. So I was part of that. I was like a double agent. I kind of party with them by night and then I signed them and I built a career for most of those artists. They became very famous and the company said like, oh, he has a talent to sign artists, so he's going to be the boss.
I remember when I first moved to Los Angeles, this was 26 years ago now. I can't believe it's that long ago. And it's around about the same time as all this stuff was going on. And my producer back at Morning Becomes Eclectic in the day, who you know very well, Ariana Morgenstern, is of Argentinian descent. And she started turning me on. She's like, if you're going to live in Los Angeles, you need to understand some of the music from Latin America. So it was her, I'll always give her credit, who turned me on to the music that was happening, not just out of Mexico, obviously, but from Argentina and Chile and lots of other places. And I remember at that time, 1998, perhaps there was a big explosion of creativity coming out of Mexico in film. You mentioned Iñárritu, Cuarón, of course, as well, and in music as well. But a lot of the musicians of your generation who grew up listening perhaps to, bands like REM and U2 and that kind of music, and then mixing that style of music with traditional Mexican music. It must have been a very creative time for you. And is that when you decided that you wanted to start making your own music?
Yeah, I mean, it was a very exciting time to be in Mexico City. Mexico City was wild. I keep telling people that it was like that movie After Hours by Scorsese, that it was like a town without a law. Every time you go by night, you end up meeting really amazing people, creative people from theater, from cinema, from the arts, and you hang with them, and all the projects were on the air. At the same time, it was very violent, and there was a lot of crime, so you could either end up jail or in a weird party or both, and it was fun. So That's why at that moment there were a lot of filmmakers and musicians, and everything was happening because there was a sort of a cluster, a creative cluster. And at the same time, I think there was a generation that tried to blend Mexican culture with more progressive or modern kind of rhythms, like a Fete Cuba or Maldita Vecindad, trying to just make something out of Mexican DNA with the influence of new wave or punk rock. And I think my generation kind of got that and tried to make it different. There were the Norte guys doing that in Tijuana.
Yeah.
And I was a record digger. So most of my collection was cumbia, and I really love cumbia, danzón, cha-cha-cha, all the Mexican, Cuban, Caribbean rhythms. So I was like, at that time, there were a lot of rave parties, and I didn't want to play house music or trance or that those rhythms. So I wanted to play cumbia, and I started doing it. And that, of course, didn't sit down well with the audience. People hated it at the beginning. I would boo and throw me bottles and that kind of stuff. But I mean, eventually we start building something, and people start like enjoying and thinking that cumbia can be something that can live in the same universe as electronic or dance music. And then I start traveling and saw that in Colombia there were a few guys doing the same, and in Argentina. And so I think it was my generation that started blending electronic music with traditional popular music from Latin America.
So initially you're doing this DJing, right? And you're taking samples and you're mixing music. When did you decide that that was something that needed to be performed, that you needed to put a band together to play this music?
I did my first album was completely laptop music, full of samples, and it was more an exercise of a computer thing. So when I started playing it, it was kind of boring, and I didn't see myself just with a laptop in front of me and just playing these beats or so. So I decided to do something more punk rock, and my heart was on that. Like I thought, like having a show that you can sweat and you can bring like the cumbia energy and the punk rock energy and hip hop and everything, put it everything in a pot. It was more fun, and so I started doing that and just putting elements, like live elements, and it became something more wild, and I started enjoying it. So I took it. I push it harder and harder, and every time it's been just an exercise of just making a live event. It's a fun thing.
And from making this music as well, a lot of people started paying attention, and people started inviting you to work with them, to produce people, to remix people. And when I think of you, I think of you first and foremost as an artist, but I also think of you, as you mentioned, connecting the dots, which is something Giles Peterson always used to say, you know, connecting those dots and bringing different things together and bringing different people together. I get the feeling that that is something that is really satisfying for you.
Yeah, I mean, probably my, I never until a few years ago, I called myself a musician. I always wanted to be a curator instead of someone that only does music. I admire musicians or artists that are not necessarily artists. No, I love Malcolm McLaren, which was half a thief, half a producer, half a impresario. I mean, he was so three-dimensional, I imagine myself as a curator and just like use music as a vehicle to do something. So sometimes I do it as a producer or as a musician or sometimes in a movie. Like, it doesn't matter really, but I like a broader idea of creating. I love create. It doesn't matter if you're in the front page or just on the credits.
one of the greatest kicks I get from the work I do, and obviously radio and television, and I work in music, in film and TV a little bit as well, is that creating something that didn't exist before, whatever that might be.
Yeah.
And until you put those elements together, even if it's just a radio show, you're creating some, or a mix, you're creating something that didn't exist before. That's what I get off on ultimately. Is it the same for you?
It is. It is. That's exciting and terrifying at the same time. And that's my rush. Like that, I live for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We've talked a little bit about film and television, and that's something that you've gotten more and more involved in recent years. I mentioned in the intro that you started off as a music supervisor, and then you started contributing music as well. I know that Coco is a film that is very close to your heart, and I read that Lee Unkrich, who was the director of that movie, contacted you by Facebook. And it's interesting, when I read that, I thought, oh, that's like me. I reach out to people on social media and see if they're interested in, you know, collaborating, doing the podcast or whatever. Tell me a little bit about that collaboration and how it came together, because I know that they really did need some help with the authenticity of the music. So how did that come about?
Yeah, I mean, I got very involved very early on the Coco process, and Lee was into my music. So he started developing the script on that, and I got early enough to do different kind of jobs in the whole process of making that film. For animation, it takes years and years, probably 5-6 years just to develop the film. So in that period, I released a couple of records, I got married, like a million things happened in my life, but I was still working. And at the beginning was just to think what kind of music it could sound on a film like that, in a town, imaginary town like that. So we did an investigation of what sort of music it should be listened. How was the first conversation I had with Lee was I wanted to get involved if the movie was accurate. And for me, that was very important, because on Disney, like all Disney films, when there's a Mexican, it's a mice with a big hat sleeping outside a bullfight plaza. And I didn't want to be
sure.
Part of that.
Yeah.
I wanted to, like, we have such a big culture, you know? So Lee was, of course, the most amazing creative person, and he wanted to do a love letter to Mexico. And it was very interesting because of that. I think Coco got political, because when the movie was almost being finished, Trump got in power, and I think having all this news about Mexico, violent and narco-traffic and illegal, it just became something very positive, and to show a very respectful face in the most Hollywood way to do it, how Mexico is. And for me, that was beautiful, just to have something that shows Mexican culture in the appropriate way.
It's a beautiful film, and I watch it a couple of times a year. I mean, Day of the Dead time or Halloween or whatever, we usually watch it then, but probably sometime other during the year. And the music is such a key part of the authenticity of the story. I would imagine that film did get a lot of attention, first of all, because it's a great film and tells a beautiful story. But also, as you mentioned, that it was released at a very difficult time politically in the United States in particular. But, you know, we do live in very difficult times right now, it seems. And I'm wondering how that is driving the music that is being made today. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about how that is impacting the music in Mexico today, because we're here 2 days before an election, a big election.
Yes.
You know, what's going on here, and how is that impacting the arts, that the music and the creative community today?
Yeah, well, I think for the people listening that are not aware of what is happening on the music scene in Mexico, I think it's the most exciting moment of Mexican music since probably the 40s. There is an explosion of artists doing regional Mexican, very modern and very young kids doing that, hip-hop, more folk music, cumbia, and they're popular. They're superstars. So it's very exciting to see everything that I fight for 20 years ago, like trying to imagine that there's a world that you can make cumbia with electronic music and hip-hop. At the beginning, 20 years ago, was a long shot, and people just boo you or throw you bottles. But I think the country has developed this sense of proudness of our culture, and it translates into artists that are having a lot of success, and they're doing pushing the limit of pop culture, and that is very exciting. It's a driving force, and I think it's a voice that for many years, like the last 5-6 years, on Latin music, it was led by Colombia with reggaeton or Puerto Rico, and now it's changing, and now we see these superstars that are the most streamed artists in the world, like Peso Pluma, that are coming from Mexico.
And you led the way, man. You led the charge.
Well, I had to walk for them to run, but I feel very proud. I feel very connected to my community. I work with a lot of those artists at my studio, so I'm very proud of what is happening, you know? Because that was my initial goal. Like, that's what I envisioned, to have, like, to push the limit of Mexican music further, and those guys are doing that.
How did the success of Coco change things for you? I imagine that you started getting more calls for working in film.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, when Coco happened, I was moving forward to do more film work, and I wanted to shift more into spend more time at the studio. So it really helped me to start developing other projects, and then I just work on Wakanda Forever, which is the Black Panther sequel, and so all those projects, it's been very interesting because they really try to do the real deal with musicians. So I feel very lucky to be involved in this sort of projects, to help all this community of artists that are in Mexico, and they help them to have visibility in a higher level. So it's always great.
Okay, let's jump into the music questions. It's the same questions for everybody who is on the show. And let's begin at the beginning. What is your first musical memory?
My first musical memory is XTC English Settlement.
Did you hear it on the radio, or did your brother play
just
it?
I saw the cover, and my brother had it, and I was like, that cover is so amazing that the music inside must be genius. And I asked my brother to play it, and I fall in love with XTC. And since then, it's my favorite band ever.
How old were you when you first heard them?
I was probably like 6. Yeah.
So they were like your Beatles. Like, I heard the Beatles when I was 6. You heard XTC.
Yeah, I mean, XTC, The Smiths, Pérez Prado. That was my... early years.
What was the first music that you bought with your own money?
Oh my God, this is not glamorous at all, but I think I bought a cassette of Billy Squier. Probably it was something that I hear on the radio.
Sure. Or,
but I don't even remember what Billy Squier sing, but I that was my first album.
You remember buying the cassette?
Yeah.
What about live music? What was the first concert you went to without any adult supervision?
I had some family in Tijuana, so I went to San Diego, and I went to see The Cure. And that completely blew my mind because it was the Kiss Me, Kiss Me, Kiss Me tour, and I was a completely cure head. So to this day, this has been the most amazing and exciting concert of my life.
Dance music is a big part of your musical DNA. So I don't know if you're going to be able to answer this question, but what do you listen to when you want to dance?
Funny enough, I don't dance, but I like...
What about after a couple of tequilas?
Yeah, after a couple of tequilas. You know what? I like political dancing. I like KLF, for example. Like I like bands that use dance music as a vehicle to a higher thought. So I like that's why I like The Clash, or that's why I like Mano Negra, or those bands that make you dance, but they have a very, very clear idea of what the world should be.
What do you listen to when you're feeling sad?
Of course, the Blue Nile, without any doubt. Probably the most melancholic band on earth, by far.
I'm a huge fan of the Blue Nile, and nobody else plays them on the radio in America, I don't think, and not in Los Angeles. But every now and then, I dig it out, and I'm a huge fan of the Blue Nile. So you probably saw my face when you said the Blue Nile. I was like, yes. Oh my God, of course, yes, of course you like the Blue Nile. This is a difficult question, I know. But if you could only hear one song for the rest of your life, what would you pick?
If I had to pick one song, I would say Etha James, At Last. It's a random, it's very hard, but I think it's such a beautiful song. It has so many layers, and if you hear it happy, it's a happy song. If you hear it sad, it's a super sad song. Yeah, it's those kind of songs that are so powerful, that, or a Velvet Underground song, Perfect Day.
You grew up in a time where music videos were still popular. I mean, people still make music videos, but, you know, we don't have music television so much anymore. But do you have a favorite music video? And if so, why?
Yes, this has to do with my childhood, but I probably would pick... Fishheads by Barnes and Barnes, because I was so intrigued about the story of the fish. Just having parties, having fun. If you haven't seen it, like, just Google it at YouTube. It's such an intriguing video.
Do you have a recent musical discovery that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Yeah, actually, I would say. I recently have been working with an artist called Luisa Almaguer. She's a very complex, profound artist that is coming from Mexico. And I had the chance to share with her some recordings at Damon Albarn's African Express. And all team were completely blown away about her talent and how amazing she is. So
I've been doing my radio show from here for the last 2 days, and you introduced me to her yesterday. I haven't heard any music, but I'm dying to hear what you guys are cooking up.
Oh yeah, very, very amazing, and it's part of a scene that is happening, like all the indie scene from Mexico City. There are a few artists that are really exciting.
What band or artist do you love, but you feel that they perhaps never quite got the break that they deserved?
It all depends. Success means so different for many people, but I hope they don't get offended. But I wish everyone knew about Suburban Lungs, for example, this band from the 80s that was very proto Talking Heads, this kind of a art rock project that combine kind of a new wave punk rock and art together.
After speaking to you for the last 30-40 minutes, I'm not sure that you're going to be able to answer this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Do you have a musical guilty pleasure?
Oh, well, that's a question that everyone, like, I have had it in the past. And for me, what guilty is not a guilty. Like I embrace like popular music. I think it's like graffiti or comic books, or like if you treat them as not high art, you're wrong. Probably they are, just not for your tastes. But so I don't know. No.
I didn't think you would, because we just talked about so many different styles of music. I was like, no way. But it's on the questionnaire, so I asked it anyway. And that's it. We have one more question. I always finish with this one, and that is, how are you feeling right now?
Well, it's been a fantastic week. Not all weeks you have Nick on your studio, like broadcasting that radio show. So I feel fantastic. It's good times for me. I'm being very creative. I live out of my creativity, so I couldn't imagine being in a better place than I am right now.
And now we're going to go have lunch with my wife, Keita, and your wife, Valerie.
Yeah.
And man, so good to hang out with you. Camilo Lara, we've known each other a long time, but I don't think we've sat down and had a conversation quite like this before.
I don't think so, yeah. But it's always a pleasure. And it's so funny to hear you and see you. I always hear you, you know, like it's such a weird sensation.
It's been great hanging out with you, and let's go get lunch.
Yes, absolutely.
Cheers. Thanks, Camilo.
Thank you.
The Sound of Success is hosted and produced by me, Nick Harcourt, for Nude and Ginger Productions. Our theme music is by Keita Klein. For more episodes, find us on Apple and Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your friends, and thanks for listening.